This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, blacks in New York protest against police brutality, and New Jersey lawmakers approve civil unions in their state. Joining us now from New York to discuss these topics are Robert George, an editorial writer at the New York Post, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of immigration studies at NYU. In Boston, we've got Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the local TV show Beat the Press. I want to thank you all for being with us and go to the Sean Bell rally in New York City. Sean Bell was the man who was shot in New York by police officers. It's revived a very difficult relationship between the police and black New York residents. Now, he was a groom-to-be right before his wedding day, and it's compared to Amadou Diallo, who was also shot by police on his doorstep. So on Saturday, there was a March for Justice against police brutality held in the city. Here's what one participant had to say.
These issues never happen in other communities. You never hear about a white man, an unarmed white man being shot, you know, 40, 50 times. It never occurs. And we need to stop it.
Callie, what's the effect of these rallies?
Well, I think that there is always power in acknowledgement. Now, you know, so there's a couple of ways to look at effect, I guess. The bottom line effect would be, of course, the rally occurs and then something changes in City Hall or the police chief sit down and talk with community leaders. That's the best of all possible scenarios. But the second part of that, I think, is equally important, and that is to for the community, however small its voice may be, to say, we know that this happened and this is not right. And we're going to continue to raise the issue until we can at least get other citizens in New York to agree that this is not something they would want to have in their communities and it needs to be addressed. So I think there's a twofold effect, and I think that it's powerful to demand acknowledgement of something that's happened that is just not right in the community.
Marcelo, you're also in the New York community, the greater New York area. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not marches and rallies have the same potency they used to. In a media-saturated world, people are going to see this, but will they heed the call? Is there anything else that's an option?
Well, surely there are multiple options here, but I think I completely agree with Callie here that the issue is one of acknowledgement. Look, this is a wound in the city. 50 shots were fired. We need transparency. We need to understand clearly what happened and what concrete steps are being taken to prevent this from happening again. And it is through transparency, it is through dialogue, it is really through the demand for justice that these issues ultimately get addressed. So I think that marches is one way of acknowledging when wrongs need to be righted. There are many, many other ways. You mentioned the internet, you mentioned media, you mentioned there are many, many ways in which citizens can make their voices heard.
Robert, what's your paper saying about this?
Well, I mean, our view from the editorial page perspective, we haven't actually weighed on the march itself, but just in the context of this particular issue, we note that this particular administration, Mayor Bloomberg, and this police commissioner Ray Kelly, already have some of the highest amounts of communication between City Hall and the black community that has been in New York in decades, probably. One area where this is very, very different from the Amadou Diallo situation was there you had Rudy Giuliani, who refused to sit down with any black leaders, not just Al Sharpton types, but elected black leaders like the Manhattan Borough President at the time, Virginia Fields, and Howard Safer, the police commissioner, was, you know, kind of similarly disengaged. I'm not quite so sure if this particular kind of a rally is going to necessarily have that kind of an impact. Aside from the idea of kind of a therapeutic for the community itself, because right now the basic process is going on, the judicial process is going on. You do have the Queens DA, Richard Brown, looking at the details of it, and he will you know make his decision within the next few weeks. So I'm not quite so sure whether, I mean, it was certainly powerful symbolically, but I don't really think this kind of a rally is going to say influence influence the judicial process.
I want to move on to Senator Obama. There's some question as to whether or not he's going to run for president in 2008, but some people are saying, go for it, dude. You know, they've already drafted him. Draft Obama is an all-volunteer organization not affiliated with the senator, and they are premiering an ad.
Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope?
We believe in making sure that everybody should have the opportunity to get a job that pays a living wage. That's something we believe in.
And we spoke with Ben Stanfield, who's the founder of DraftObama.org, about Obama's potential as a candidate.
I think it's his ability to transcend almost everything about our politics in America today. You know, he has the unique ability for a Democrat to reach out to people like evangelical Christians, to reach across racial lines with, his black father and white mother. He has the ability to reach across economic lines and liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. He has the ability to transcend that and just spread that message of hope that he talks about so much in his books and his speaking.
Robert, I want to start singing We Are the World, We Are the Children.
Kumbaya, my friends, kumbaya.
So what are we to make of this, you know, outside campaigning?
I think it is kind of nice that there is sort of a kind of a feel-good story about politics, though. I think I can speak for all journalists when I say that the first answer to Mr. Obama's question is, I'm sorry, but the politics of cynicism will actually end up trumping the politics of hope, because that's kind of. Pardon my cynicism, but that's kind of the way that the system works. Because, you know, I think it is very true that he is certainly trying to work with evangelicals, you know, cross certain kind of lines. But what happens is you end up the process ends up kind of weeding out this kind of feel goodness and start looking at basic brass tacks TACKS issues. And when it comes to he is supportive of, for one example, late-term abortions, partial birth abortions. That is automatically going to cleave away at that a certain segment of the populace right there, and you're going to end up getting to a position where the issues will start transcending even his own personal great charisma, which is dramatic.
We're talking to Robert George. He's an editorial writer at the New York Post. Of course, this is News and Notes, and I'm Farai Chidea, and we also have Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of immigration studies at New York University in Boston, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the TV show Beat the Press. So, Callie, let me go to you next. You know, it's really nice to have other people making your ambitions happen. To what degree is this significant, that other people are really trying to carry the Obama banner?
Here's what's significant about it to me is that, remember, we may have forgotten, there's a draft Condi movement too. She's dismissed it many times, but it still exists in terms of getting her to think about running for office. So I think anytime you have these outside groups trying to foment some interest and stir up some interest and boost the candidate, it's something that the potential candidate has to pay attention to. I think what's interesting to me is that we have two black people for the first time having outside groups trying to get them to consider running for the highest office in the land, however real that may be.
Which just goes to prove that the draft impacts black people more than it does white people.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah,
oh,
on
Robert.
Many levels. Let me just say this, though. I think that everything that Robert said is true about, you know, cynicism and all that's going to come into play as people start looking very carefully and picking him apart. But I think what's really interesting is his language of the last several days. He has said he is not a boomer. Now, if I'm an African-American, and maybe I'm just, you know, paranoid, I interpret that as, you know, I'm post-civil rights generation, too, which says something different about it. I'm a different kind of guy. I'm a different kind of black person. I think I can cross some boundaries that other folks haven't been able to cross. And I also think I can bring together some groups that haven't done it before. And so even if he, in the end, decides not to run, I just think the language and how he positions himself while others are trying to run around and boost him is very, very interesting. Is something we should pay attention to.
Well, let me ask you about this. When you talk about his language around generations, no one has a really great set of language around the post-civil rights generations. There's, you know, civil rights generation, and then all of most of the terms are hip-hop generation, Generation X. Are you saying that he needs a term to describe who he is? He keeps implying that he's a new generation of leader, but does he need more language around that?
Well, I think he'll probably get some more language about it. What I'm implying, what I'm just saying flat out, is that he's making it clear, I am not of the Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, for lack of a better, you know, example at this moment. You know, they did what they did, but I'm a different kind of leader. I'm going in a different direction. I'm appealing to different groups. And I think that that sets him up for an interesting race if he decides to run. And these are the, and I just think it's interesting that those are the messages that he's putting out. And for him to reach out and take Boomer and say, I am not a Boomer, is really pretty powerful.
Marcella, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that, like in the previous story, this is really fundamentally an issue in the symbolic realm. I think that the senator senses a huge hunger for change. There's clearly here an appetite for a new vision, a new voice, and he is thriving in that context. Now, there's also a Rorschach effect here, which is people see what they want to see now. As the campaign unfolds, if the senator joins the race, things will come to be defined in a much sharper angle, and at that point, these symbolic issues that are now somewhat amorphous will become very, very focused. And we will know exactly what the senator means when he invokes this post-boomer, post-civil rights imagery in his language, in his demeanor, in the ethos he's grafting around himself.
If I were to add on to that, you know, if I could coin a phrase, instead of thinking of this as Generation X, we might want to start thinking of this as Generation Malcolm, as in Malcolm X. In this way, what we saw in the last election, we saw Deval Patrick win up in Massachusetts. We saw Harold Ford run a very, very strong race in Tennessee. We saw Michael Steele run a strong race in Maryland. And I think with Obama, you are starting to see a real generational shift among black candidates. And part of it is definitely certainly more of a kind of a mainstream post-civil rights agenda. But on top of that, something that Obama in particular brings is that third world element. He's the son of a Kenyan and a white mother as well. And so it becomes a mixture of both sort of the business and educational opportunities that a whole new generation of black Americans have had, but also linking it specifically with the immigrant waves and viewpoints that have also now started to change the debate of race within America as well. So I think that is also definitely a strong, powerful symbol that he brings in.
I guess that's latter Malcolm X, not so much the earlier.
Latter Malcolm. Well, yeah, it's a combination mm-hmm. of both the former and the latter.
All right. Well, one more quick topic. Reparations. And, you know, African Americans have been fighting for reparations for years. You know, companies that still exist today profited from slavery, including leaving long records of what they'd done to sell slaves or insure slaves. A federal appeals court revived at least part of a reparations lawsuit last week, and the companies could be held liable if they lied about their ties to slavery to avoid negative publicity. Speed lightning round, Callie, is this a move forward?
A half a step forward. That's what I would say. It's because the rest of the case, the ruling seems most negative. So it's a half a step forward.
And Marcelo,
I'm going to be speedy. So
no, that was great, Marcelo.
Well, the devil dwells in the details here, so it will be a function of exactly how the lawsuits proceed in terms of again making transparent which companies lied about what were the profits. So we're in for an education. Stay tuned.
All right. Whoever has that cell phone is hurting me personally, but that's okay. We'll move along. Robert?
It's not me. I can definitely – I'm pleading not guilty on that one. I think it's a lot of background noise, to pardon the expression here, that I just don't really believe that the whole reparations movement as such is really an effective way or an effective use of the community's energies, frankly. And I think that this is, I think the larger lawsuit will eventually fade away.
Callie, we have been so efficient, you get another go. What do you think about the longevity of reparations, where you've got people like, Ogletree at Harvard, Professor mm-hmm. Charles Ogletree, saying we can make this happen? Will it happen? Will there be reparations eventually in some way or the other?
Well, part of the problem is a lot of the descendants are dying. Some of the ones in the direct conflict, such as the one that Professor Ogletree is representing, those people out in Oklahoma. And I think that the reparations is going to turn on the direct connection. Because in this lawsuit, we saw the guy say, the judge say, well, you know, it's been 150 years and we can't prove the direct connection. So the more cases that can advance that have that direct connection, I think, keeps the conversation going, even if Robert thinks it's background noise. But I do think that just this little piece that got forward might be very interesting to see how it pans out.
Well, that is perfect. Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator, came to us from WGBH in Boston. Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU, and Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.